There are no new handouts, but if you missed either of the previous two classes, check back there to make sure you have everything. And I have some of the completion cards from Mind and Its Potential. There are more coming, but if I haven't returned it to you, please check with me, and we'll get those to you. I think that's all I have right now.
Robbie asked me if I was prepared for tonight. Good question, Robbie. Since it's a review, I should be prepared. Sometimes these things just won't do what they're supposed to, so I put it in my pocket. Okay, so welcome. Anybody, I think everybody looks familiar. Oh, you know what, Joanne? I just thought about something. I looked at my old book, you know, the red one, and it's day 1 through 3. Those are the reading days. So did you change the page numbers for people? It's supposed to be day 1 through 3. That's the reading assignment in this text, basically. Holy moly.
Day 1.
Day 3 is quick. There it is.
Study and teach the Dharma is the last one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we had two. If they have an older copy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay, good.
But, yeah.
Day 1 through, yeah, through page 100. Perfect.
For the new edition.
Yeah, for the newer edition. All right, well, anyway. If you buy Dharma books, you end up buying multiple copies of the same book. It happens a lot.
It changed the name.
Yeah. Or the cover, and you go, wow, I don't have that book. Next thing you know, you have it. Okay. All right. Okay. How to meditate? Did Steve do, you know, go through the preliminary practices? And did you guys do refuge and bodhicitta? Did you do the standard prayers in the book?
Not really.
No. Okay. Well, then. Tell you what, we'll do it next time. We'll make sure everybody has a book, and we'll do it next time because I think we need to get into the routine of doing the preparatory practices. You know,
refuge and
bodhicitta, and maybe 4 measurables and 7 limb and the mandala offering. We can do all those. It doesn't take long. All right, so. Maybe we'll just start out with a little spacing out meditation. Let everybody get present. We need to start out by watching the breath for maybe 5 to 7 breaths, And then I want you to we're going to do something a little different than our usual focus practice, you know, where we usually take an object like the breath or something like that. We're going to just let the mind, we're just going to watch the mind. Watch it wiggle, watch it go every which way. But the key is not to get lost in thought, but just to watch it. So we'll start out by focusing on the breath. In this type of practice, the key thing to watch is impermanence, a subtle impermanence, change that's happening at least 65 times in a finger snap. But you know, that's one of the measures of a mind moment. But whatever comes into one's awareness, be it sound, smell, sensation, feeling, thought, whatever predominates in your awareness, or whatever dominates your awareness, I guess is a better way to say it, that's what you pay attention to without pushing it away, without getting involved in it. We might just notice thinking. Or feeling pain. Or distracted. Whatever it is, just be present with your experience as it changes moment to moment. about now, you may be thinking, this is really boring. Just notice that thought. And again, open your the lens of your awareness to experience whatever is there. So you remember we talked about the three scopes primarily having to do with the goal for practice. The initial scope would be just, you know, your goal is to achieve a better rebirth. And the intermediate scope of practice, the goal is to achieve nirvana, complete cessation of suffering for oneself. It's just motivation is for oneself to be free of suffering. And in the Mahayana, which is what we aspire to practice, although if we're really honest, we may not even be practicing Dharma at all, but our motivation may not fall into any of these scopes, but the Mahayana motive is for others. Like we practice, we work on ourselves to try to cultivate, you know, our positive qualities. We have some, you know, we all have some. No matter how wretched you might think you are, at times, you know, we all have some wisdom, some compassion, some loving kindness, some power, some ability to know what to do in a situation, what's the most appropriate thing to do to be the greatest benefit. We all have some of those qualities already, and they can be enhanced, they can be grown, increased over time with effort. So the goal for a Mahayana practitioner is to is to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of others. So from the get-go, the focus is out for others. Why do you want to become enlightened? For others. Why are you working so hard? For others. Why are you living ethically and putting all this time and effort in developing your mind? For others. It is just completely antithetical to our biggest enemy, the selfish, self-cherishing ego. You know, for others, ego really doesn't like that. The egocentricity, the mind, the self-cherishing, selfish mind, has no interest in others. And that is the source of suffering for everyone. From the beginning of beginningless time till now, one demon, the selfish, self-cherishing, I-grasping. The opposite of that is cherishing others. the bodhicitta, this awakening mind, is so perfect. Perfect antidote to our biggest enemy. As much as you can, adjust your motivation for being here tonight for the benefit of others. Yeah, I think you have to make this real. When you think of others, like, it's infinite, right? Others are infinite. So, you know, others include your family, you know, your loved ones, your community at work, and your friends, and your extended family, and your community, and everything beyond that. It's vast, but you know, we are, to make it really hit home, I think we have to make it real for us, which is, you know, if you have children, you know, you're practicing so that you can be become a Buddha, or at least get closer to that goal, so you can be a better parent, more patient, more wise, and so on. Okay, so now we start all over again. Actually, tonight we're going to read the three principal aspects of the path. Joanne, everybody, is this the text from Ramayashi Wisdom Archive? Is that the one? I think it's the same one in the book.
It's in the book.
Yeah. I don't know if people have this. The two, you know, one of the, those of you who are doing this for credit, you have to memorize one Lam Rim prayer. And the one that I would recommend would be not this one. Actually, I like this one. I'm trying to memorize it myself, but I haven't gotten there yet. Foundation of all good qualities is not that hard. I think it's memorizable too, also. But this is, remember we talked about, yes, please. Well, that's a dedication prayer. That's not a Lam Rim prayer. But it's good to memorize that too. this is a prayer that encompasses the whole path, okay? So we'll do this. Now we'll read it together, and then we'll stop at the end of each stanza, because I want to give you some overview again, because we've been gone for 3 weeks. Some people are new, and I want to make sure we pull everybody back in, get everybody up to speed. Remember I said last week, this is just probably a dead horse, but anyway, I just think it's important, and I've thought about this, gosh, why do we go through all this reading, all these prayers, and discussing in incredible detail about every step along the path, and there's the three of this and the four of that and the six paths, and it goes on and on. The lists are incredible. And but, you know, we do talk about the sutra and then the Vajrayana, the tantric path, and how they work together, you know, so we can go all the way using the Lam Rim from our present state of whatever, confusion, gradually, all the way up to where we're qualified to practice Tantra, and then we can practice Tantra at different levels, and there's a highest level where we actually start working with the energies of the, no longer dealing with, you know, concrete mind, but working with this, what they call the subtle energy system, which you will not find in a gross anatomy lab, you know, the chakras and the channels and the nadis and so forth. But they're these subtle psychic energies. So Tantra works at that level. There's so much. You know, there's really quite a bit to know. But it's nice to know. Like I said, when you were coming here tonight, you had an idea how to get here. And you knew you could get here. You know? Otherwise, you would never have gotten in a car. In the same way, I think it's helpful for us to at least mentally identify the main points in the path and maybe get some feeling for what it might be like to practice and have some experience of these points. So, that being said, the three scopes is one way that we package the teachings, okay? Three scopes, we talked about that a moment ago, right? The initial scope, motivation for a good rebirth. The intermediate scope, motivation is for liberation. You know, if your motivation is for liberation, is that the next life or is that this life? It's sometime, isn't it? Could be this life. You could be practicing for this life. Yes. And then future, and then the goal for the Mahayana practitioner is supreme enlightenment, right? When's that supposed to happen? Could happen in this life. So we think, you know, future lifetimes. I mean, really, it takes a long time to change our mind. But hey, it could happen in this life. They say, if you're ripe and you get all your ducks in a row, in 3 years, 3 months and 3 days, you can get enlightened. You got any? Bring your checkbook. We want to make a deal here. Sounds good, doesn't it? That's a little bit of a advertisement. But that's, you know, most of these long retreats are 3 years, 3 days, and 3 months. People do these long tantric retreats. And if you're a suitable practitioner of a tantra, you can make, you know, incredible progress in those long retreats. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Let's do the foundation of all good qualities. Now, I'm going to stop after each one of these just to give you a little touch of what I think is important. All right. The first one, you can see the just above it. I don't know if it says it in the book. It says expressing the homage. Okay. What we read is, I bow down to my perfect gurus. So every text starts out, that's in Lam Rim, that's the most important part. In fact, if you look at this outline that I gave, yeah, you remember this outline that I handed out last week? Alright, the first, there are two, Roman numeral 1 and Roman numeral 2. Roman numeral 1 is the root of the path, how to take a teacher. I mean, that's like the root of the path. And there's an A and a B under that. And then Roman numeral 2 is everything else that I'm going to cover, that we cover in the Lam Rim. So taking a teacher is huge, because if you get the wrong teacher, you can waste a lot of time. You get the wrong teacher, you know, I don't even want to go there. You know how bad things can get if you get the wrong teacher. Somebody whose motivation isn't pure and who doesn't have the wisdom to guide you because they really haven't done the work on themselves and so on. So having a proper teacher is crucial. And if we're fortunate enough to meet a fully qualified guru, lama, teacher, they all mean the same thing. Usually guru means heavy with qualities. You know, that's the Sanskrit definition, I believe. But in any case, that is always going to be a big deal. Always going to be a big deal. And it's not a surprise. We know that to really learn something well, we need a good teacher. Okay. The essential meaning, this is the promise to compose. The essential meaning, let's read this together. The essential meaning of the Victorious One's teachings, the path praised by all the holy victors and their children, the gateway of the fortunate one's desire and liberation, this I shall try to explain as much as I can. So Lama Tsongkhapa is saying, I'm going to do this. And he's trying to persuade us to listen. Those who are not attached to the pleasures of circling, who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path pleasing the victorious ones, you fortunate ones, listen with a calm mind. So we're going to touch on this in just a moment, but you're not attached to the pleasures of circling. So you see the wheel of life right outside the door. You know, that's the wheel of samsara, life and birth and death and birth and death and birth and death. And so we've all been, according to the scriptures, we've all experienced countless births and deaths. You know, many, many, many times we've been, and so now we're saying, hey, I'm ready to get off that train. That wheel is not going anywhere. So those who aren't attached to that pleasure of circling, who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful. So I'm going to talk about this. I did last week too. Freedom and endowment. So that's sometimes it's called the precious human rebirth, PHR. You know, you'll hear Buddhist, you know, say, how's your PHR of the day, you know? And not everybody has a PHR, you know? Just because you're a human being doesn't mean you have a perfect human rebirth, or a precious human rebirth. What constitutes a PHR? So there's, you know, there's 8 freedoms and 10 endowments. 8 freedoms and 10 endowments. That doesn't help, does it? So I'll give you the rough answer to that is, well, you're human. You're not born in hell. You're not an animal. You're not, you know, a Bambi or, you know, some cockroach or something like that, or a fish in the ocean. You're human, and you have the faculties. You can understand and process information. You're not deaf, dumb, and blind. You know, you're not born in a boat. We're not born in a barbaric country where if we tried to study the Dharma, we'd be killed or tortured or whatever, and so on. So there's, you know, we have all the faculties. We have all the, we're endowed with the things that we need to practice. Not everybody is. Not everybody is. And I think, I'm not sure if this is one of the endowments or not, I can't remember. But one of the things we're endowed with is an interest in practicing. You know, we actually showed up. We have some connection with the Dharma. And the freedoms are things like, again, some of this is redundant, but like we're not born in bad places and hell realms and hungry ghost realms and animal realms and God realms and places where we'd be distracted by suffering or too much pleasure. We've just the right amount of suffering in the human realm. And we're born at a time when, we have an interest. We're born at a time when a Buddha has descended. So this is all very interesting, but maybe not to you, but Shakyamuni Buddha was the fourth great teaching Buddha of that. There will be 1,000 supposedly in this great eon. He was the fourth, the one that 2,600 years ago. Now many beings have achieved, you know, the teachers say many beings have achieved enlightenment, but he was like the spark that set off this whole big thing called the Buddha Dharma for the last 2,600 years. So he was the fourth great teaching Buddha. you know, so he's in his... Where was I going with this? Help me. Oh, yes, yes, precious. So, yeah, so we're lucky in that the Buddha has descended. And not only has descended, because sometimes Buddhas descend, but they won't teach. Because they look around and they see, well, look, there's nobody that's really open. Nobody's mind, everybody's wisdom eye is so clouded that there's nobody that's going to get it. So a Buddha won't teach. So we live at a time when a Buddha's descended, the Buddha's taught. Then there are people that have actually, for 2,600 years, has been an unbroken lineage of teachers and students, and the students learn the material, internalize the teachings, and teach others, and it just goes, you know, it rolls like that. So we're fortunate enough to live at a time when there's this unbroken lineage of teachings from the time of the Buddha up until now, realized teachers. And even more amazing, here we are in Raleigh, North Carolina, which by all rights should be a Dharma desert. But, it's not. It's not. We have Geshe Gelug and Geshe Sampo, who committed their lives to the Dharma, and a whole community of people. And we have Lama Zopa who comes to visit, and Venerable Rubina and George Turner. We have, a lot of wonderful opportunities to connect with people who are committed. So that's even more amazing. So, precious human rebirth. A lot of people aren't here tonight. Even some of the people that said they would be didn't make it. So, this place isn't, they're not 10,000 people here, right? This is, only a few people really have a connection with the Dharma, karmic connection. It's not everybody. So not everybody has a precious human rebirth. And that's something to really think about. It's something to rejoice in, that we have a human life, And we have a mind that works, and we've come into contact with this. I'm going to say this is the path for some people that will give you the greatest opportunity to find the happiness that you want in your heart of hearts. Like, have your dreams come true. It won't be for everybody, but it does work for a lot of people. So, it's that's called a precious human rebirth. Now, pretty rare to get one. Hard to find. Hard to get. What the cause of precious human rebirth is, a couple of things. One is you have to make a lot of prayer to get one, and you have to live ethically. Those are the main causes for a good rebirth. Now, they talk about the rarity of it, and they like to use examples. And one of my favorite example is, if you grabbed a bunch of pickup sticks and threw them on the ground, what are the chances of it spelling your name perfectly? Be a long time, wouldn't it? You'd be throwing sticks down for a long time, particularly if you have a long name. Another example is this blind turtle. I love this example. So this blind turtle, he goes under the ocean, and under the ocean is like the lower realms. Anybody know what the lower realms are? Good, you'll learn about them later. But the lower realms are the joyless realms. In Buddhism, the mind can create hell, right? Or heaven. Can create anything. So the lower realms are actual places that the mind creates that are joyless. And there are three levels. I won't go into a lot of detail about them right now, but these joyless realms, the animal realms, would be one of those realms. And anyway, this blind turtle, he's under the ocean for 100 years in the lower realms, right? And then there's a golden yolk that's floating on the surface of the ocean. And the blind turtle comes up every 100 years to get a breath of air, and goes back down for another 100 years. What are the chances of that turtle poking his head through the golden yolk on this vast ocean? That's how rare a perfect human rebirth is. So we should all be going, yippee, we should be really rejoicing that we have this amazing opportunity. Good fortune, good karma has ripened that we can practice. So understanding the preciousness of this life is an antidote to feeling terrible about yourself and about feeling like your life is meaningless. Because a lot of us do. There are a lot of people out there whose don't live what if you ask them, and I do ask people because I deal with people. I mean, is your life meaningful? I think a lot of people would say no. They might say on the surface, of course it is. But you dig a little deeper, I think a lot of people are lost looking for meaning in their lives. So that's an important issue. So precious human rebirth. Moving right along here. Who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path of the victorious one. So that's the Buddha Dharma. You fortunate ones listen with a calm mind. So, again, Lama Tsongkhapa is saying that you're fortunate. If you have all of this, then by all means, listen and listen with a calm mind, not with an agitated mind. Then he goes, the purpose of renunciation. So this we went over last week a little bit. Without the complete intention, definitely to be free from circling, there's no way to pacify attachment seeking pleasurable effects in the ocean of circling. Also, by craving for cyclic existence, embodied beings are continuously bound. Therefore, at the very beginning, seek renunciation. So, remember what we said renunciation is. You can think of renunciation, because you don't see this term very often, but, you know, in Buddhism, what's the definition of compassion? Robbie cannot answer. What's the definition of compassion? Pardon? Yeah. I wish that others could be free of suffering and of cross. That's compassion. Okay. Now, we don't talk about compassion for ourselves, but this is it right here. This is called compassion for yourself. This renunciation, this determination for you to be free of suffering. Okay? And I thought about this. You know, to actually have this be real for us, first of all, we have to believe we're suffering. So again, we're going to study that tonight. That'll be interesting. but a lot of people don't think, you know, yes, well, is your life suffering? No. I mean, I've got a family and car and a house and a boat and a plane and whatever people have. You know, they have stuff and they have all the symbols of success. And they wouldn't necessarily say they're suffering. But dig a little deeper. Everybody's got their own story, don't they? Everybody's got something going on that's digging at them. And we're all going to have to deal with some biggies, like sickness, aging, old age, and death. Everybody gets to do that if they live long enough. And those, Justin, forget about the rest of it, those are all huge. Huge. And we don't get to, like, skip those. Those are things we don't have to deal with. So having this determination to be free of suffering and its causes is renunciation. And for us to truly have renunciation, not only do we have to identify suffering at all the different levels, really understand it deeply, but we also have to have some faith that it's possible to be free of it, right? Because that's what we're saying. The wish to be free of suffering and its causes. So, oh my gosh. I mean, you have to have faith. Now this goes right back again to the teacher. I think this is so important. This is why I think, for me, my teachers are by the Dharma lives for me through them. Because I can see that they're not ordinary people. You know, when I met Lama Yeshe and when I met Lama Zopa and I've heard, you know, I had some contact with the Dalai Lama, but I've heard him speak so many times. And, you know, these are, to me, again, my projection, these are extraordinary human beings. And they really bring the teachings to life. Otherwise, well, you wonder, is this really going to take us anywhere? But these people are the exponents. These are the results of practicing the path. So, again, we'll read. Now, the next one is how to generate renunciation. So there's two things in here, the two little stanzas. The first two lines have to do with, precious human rebirth and death and impermanence. And the second two lines have to do with karma and suffering. Okay? The first two lines we mentioned last week were, if we can meditate on how precious this life is and the fact that it could be over any moment. Precious because we can use it to transform ourselves, right? That's why it's precious. Not because we can make more money and have more stuff. I mean, that's all good and nothing wrong with it, but from a spiritual perspective, it's precious because we can develop our qualities and eliminate our faults and become a perfect guide for others. That's why it's precious. So, precious human rebirth could be over any minute, any second. Again, that helps us turn our mind away from just the happiness of this life. You see that? Just think about this a little bit. Precious life could be over any moment. Precious because we can use it to work on our mind and develop it. So we want to use every second, use every microsecond of the rest of this life to develop ourselves. So to turn away from the meaningless activities of this life. Now, that's a whole other conversation, isn't it? What's meaningless? So let's read this stanza. Freedom endowments are difficult to find, and life has no time to spare. By gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. By thinking over and over again that actions and their effects are unbetraying, and repeatedly contemplating the miseries of cyclic existence, attraction to the appearances of future lives is reversed. So going to the second of these, over and over again, actions and their effects are unbetraying. So that's karma, isn't it? And your whole class next time is on karma. So, there's laws of karma, but the one that we know, the sort of the pedestrian version of karma is what goes around comes around. What you sow, you reap. So, where's my bag here? I have a gift for everybody. Whoops. Don't tell me I've lost it. Is it on the floor? Oh, here it is. There's some good laws of karma. So one of the laws of karma is that positive actions always lead to happiness. And a positive action is one that is performed with a beneficial motivation, i.e. non-attachment, non-hatred, non-ignorance. Okay? So positive leads to positive or happiness. Negative leads to negative. So, it's called an impersonal there's no God in here that's making this up, by the way. This isn't the Buddhist version of this. There's no controller of it. It's like gravity. You suffer, it's not personal. Gravity is not personal. It doesn't care. You jump off a building, it doesn't care who you are. It just is. So positive. And this, again, I give this to you. I'm offering this as something for you to creatively align with and to live your life as if it were true. Not because I can 100% prove it. A lot of us can intuit it. But the more faith that you have in karma, the more benefit you derive from it. And it's said, because, one of the claims that Buddhist teachings make is that everything is verifiable by the individual. Well, it's going to be a long time before we can verify this. But it said it can be even karma can be verified when? When you get enlightened. So, long time, maybe, possibly. But, so positive, very important thing to think about. Positive actions lead to happiness. Negative actions lead to suffering. Now here's another one that's really cool. Think about it. This is a watermelon seed. Robbie, I want you to pass. Everybody take a watermelon seed. I want you to see this, baby. I paid good money for these seeds, by the way. Yeah. No, these came from Lowe's. But watermelon seeds karmic seeds in our mind. Slightest, tiniest little moment of anger, nastiness, snittiness, shittiness, whatever you want to call it. Any moment of mind where we plant those kinds of seeds get planted in our mind. You say, well, I'm a nice person. I don't go around dissing people and beating them up or being, you know, nasty. But guess what? One little moment of, you know, just of that kind of behavior, it said karma expands, grows like a wildfire. So, anybody see a watermelon here? How big? At the State Fair, they got watermelons this big. Seed can become a watermelon. And so, any actions, positive or negative, they, from the moment they get planted, they start expanding. Karma is expandable. Karmic seeds grow exponentially. So one little moment of kindness, all, you know, is going to ripen in something positive. One little moment, and you know, this could explain why bad things happen to nice people, because nice people aren't always nice, are they? Sometimes I like thinking of myself as a nice person, but you know what? I'm not always nice. You know, it doesn't take but a moment of plant, you know, of a negative mind state, and then boom, you got a watermelon crashing down in your head. And you go, oh my gosh, how did that happen? Well, it's there because you planted the seed. That's the view of karma. Now, the other karmic law that's cool, this, again, and this sort of is the Buddhist version of why there's no, why it's non-theistic. It says that you cannot experience a result without creating the cause. Now, Joanna, I don't know how many times I've asked you this, and I've told this story so many times that I'm sure I've twisted it. But Joanna, you remember when we were in the Unitarian Church? You and Bill Judge in the basement of the Unitarian Church, we were in the nursery because the diaper pails were stinking up the place. I remember that too. Yeah, but anyway, it was back in the day before we had a center, and I was teaching class kind of like this one, and I was talking about, well, you can't experience a result without creating the cause. So this one created a real stink. No pun, you know, not just the diaper pails, because we were sitting in this little skinny room on the floor, and there were two ladies sitting in front of me, and one of them, did I tell this story already, by the way? I find it good. So one of the women was, she had been sexually abused by her father from an early age, you know, for like 5 or more years. And she was in her late 20s at the time, and she was just complete. She was really a mess. I mean, that's kind of how she described herself. I'm a mess. I mean, I'm on medicine. I've been in therapy. I'm damaged goods, kind of was her perspective. And she couldn't get over it. And she was still holding on to the fact that she had been abused. She really identified, I think that really, more than maybe anything, defined who she was at some level. That was my interpretation. But she had a real problem with, you can't experience a result without creating the cause. Like, what did I do? What did I do to deserve to be treated like this? I was just a little kid. I didn't do anything wrong. And I, you know, my answer to you, you didn't do anything wrong. I don't think a 5-year-old kid, you know, did anything wrong or was asking for that. But according to karma, right, and it's not personal. You know, it's like gravity. It's not personal. At some point, this is, again, the Buddhist explanation for everything. At some point in the past, when this mental continuum, which is like a river going through, like the Nile River going through Africa, you know, winding through different countries, getting different names wherever it goes, but it's a continuum. The mental continuum goes from lifetime to lifetime, and within each lifetime, seeds get planted. These seeds get planted. And when they ripen, who knows? There are what we call cooperative causes for seeds to ripen. Like, if you get born into a family where the father's unstable and, you know, has, you know, issues with whatever, you know, fathers that abuse their daughters have, that's the cooperative cause for that karmic seed to ripen, and you get raped, or you get sexually abused. So it's really, this is a heavy subject. But this lady was totally distraught about it and didn't want to talk about karma at all when we started talking about this. And the lady next to her, sitting right next to her, said, "The same thing happened to me." It was uncanny. She said, "My dad started sexually abusing me when I was about 5 or 6. This went on for 5 or 6 or 7 years. I went all the way through my teens, just angry, angry, angry." And she said, "I went to a class, a workshop, and it wasn't about karma, but it was about taking responsibility. Not because God said so, or the Buddha said so, or wasn't based on any understanding of cause and effect, karma. But it was like, okay, I'm going to choose to take responsibility. Not like I understand it, but it's just going to be a choice that I make. I'm going to choose not to be a victim in my life. I'm going to choose my life and to take full accountability for it. Not like I'm to blame for being, you know, sexually abused, but I'm going to choose to be responsible." So, and she said, from that moment on, the burdens began to fall away. And it took a year or two for her to get over herself, but, you know, she was like a, you know, her eyes were bright, she was an attractive young woman, she was married and had a good job, and you could tell she was well adjusted. And this other lady, you know, for whatever reason, couldn't let go. And I look at the difference between taking responsibility and being a victim. And karma, really, the basic message for me in karma is, I'm responsible for everything, even if I don't understand how. And it's a place to come from in life. Not that I can, it's not relevant to go back 15,000 lifetimes ago and realize that you sexually abused your daughter and now you're getting sexually abused as a daughter. You know, that didn't help. I mean, maybe logically it might be give you something to think about, but that's probably not going to help your mind in a moment. But understanding karma, the take-home message is that we create our future and we're responsible for whatever's coming up now. It's all in our hands. That's the point. I think that really is the message. And so the last law of karma is that whatever we do, it's never lost. Positive karmic seeds never get lost. These babies, if they're positive, they will ripen at some point in the future. And negative karmic seeds, positive seeds will ripen in happiness, and negative karmic seeds will ripen in suffering. Now, that's the good news and the bad news. But here's the good news. Here's more good news. We can purify these guys. If I take a blowtorch and burn that seed, it can never, you know, grow a grapefruit. I mean, a watermelon, excuse me. Yeah, whatever, fruit. It can never come to fruition. The seed is destroyed. So this is what purification practice is. This is what we talked about last week, you know, the four opponent powers. So I tell you what, now, maybe I'm naive, but when I heard about karma and I started meditating on it, and I heard people say karma is dangerous, I really believed them. I could see how so many things had happened in my life, and there was a sense of being caught in a, you know, on a cycle and doing stuff and motivation not being all that positive and having negative things come up over and over again and going, oh gosh, I got to get off this wheel. And if karma's true, I'm in big trouble. And so I really started taking a real interest in purifying my karma. And to this day, I'm still very interested in it. And I'm also interested in not creating more negative karma. So that's our big job these days. So, again, let's go back over here and let's talk about this. Thinking over and over again that action things and their effects are unbetraying. So, karma, you know, again, if you have problems with it, just creatively align with it for the next 4 weeks. See what happens. I don't think you have, and you can go back to believing that actions have no consequences later on. But for the next 4 weeks, it'd be useful to really think seriously that everything is dependent. All of what we experience is dependent on past actions, and the future's in our hands now. And by the way, I didn't say this, but the key component in karma is your motivation. Your motivation is everything. If it's selfish, you know, an action that looks positive, like I said, putting a $1,000 check in the donation box at Kadampa Center so you can look good, make sure everybody sees your check and then put it in there. Well, there's some virtue in that, but it's also tainted, isn't it? It's tainted. So the motivation is the crucial thing in karma. All right, moving right along here. Definition of having generated renunciation. When, by having trained in that way, there's no arising, even for a second, of attraction to the perfections of cyclic existence, and all day and night the intention seeking liberation arises, then the thought of renunciation has been generated. Day and night, the intention seeking liberation arises, and the thought of renunciation has been generated. There's one example in the text that they use. It's kind of a, anyway, it's kind of a wicked one, but it's like, you know, if your hair was on fire, you would be looking for a place to put out the fire, wouldn't you? You'd be looking for the fire extinguisher. You're looking for the water, looking for the pool. So it's that kind of attitude of a sense of urgency too that's necessary, that's said to be part of this notion of renunciation. Is that it's like your hair's on fire. You recognize your suffering, and you got to stop it. You want to stop it, and you want to do it now. So there's so that's a pretty poignant image of your hair being on fire. But what we want to do is stop our suffering. And renunciation is the foundation of the practice. It's the foundation of the practice. Why is that? Why do you think it's so important? Anybody? I have talked about it, but why do you think it's so important?
I mean, on a fundamental level, it's putting into practice what you want to do. Right? I mean, if you're not renunciating bad things and you're just kind of going along and feeling it, then you're not increasing how you're living. You're not increasing the ethics of how you're living.
Okay. I can see that. But there's something a little bit that I'm looking for, a little bit more profound, I think. Anybody else have any thoughts about it?
Speaking out that it's a turning point, or just being vocal about that.
Yeah, I mean, it is a turning point.
That you see a path, and you need to go down it, and you recognize that.
And what else do you recognize? Remember, I said renunciation is having what? Yeah, compassion for yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, having compassion for yourself is the start of everything. You know, having compassion for everyone else, you have to start with yourself.
Yeah, and so if you don't think you have a problem, you know, if you don't see, first of all, if you don't see that you're suffering at some level, your life will never turn out, you can never be satisfied, no matter how much you have, no matter how many, whatever, vacations and girlfriends or boyfriends or whatever, no matter how extraordinary it is and can be in terms of samsaric experiences, never going to work out. You're never going to find lasting true happiness. And so until we come to grips with our own suffering, there's no incentive to want to practice. So this is, to me, it's like the rocket fuel. It's the first booster rocket of a, you know, a, you're shooting a rocket up into space. This is like the first booster to get it off the ground. You have to have it. And it's it is very, very hard to develop it because we're so attached to worldly pleasures. It's just how we are. We don't have a choice in the matter right now. We're just, you know, so on automatic pilot about that. And the thought of achieving liberation, enlightenment, it seems so far away. Okay, so let's keep going here. The purpose of generating the mind of life. Even if renunciation has been developed, if it is not possessed by the mind of enlightenment, it does not become the cause of the perfect bliss of unsurpassed enlightenment. Therefore, the wise generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. So he's saying renunciation is not enough. You got to have bodhicitta or the mind of enlightenment. Remember the three principal aspects of the path? But renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. So here we're talking about the mind of enlightenment or bodhicitta. So now we're going on how to generate the mind of enlightenment. And so these next two lines are, they're talking about how it's not just us suffering. It's like everybody's in the same boat. We're all caught up in a fantasy world where we believe in appearances and we torture ourselves and others because of our mistaken perceptions. And we're all in this together. We're all suffering together. So he says, swept away by the current of four powerful rivers, tied by the tight bonds of karma, so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped in the total darkness of ignorance, endlessly reborn in cyclic existence, ceaselessly tormented by the three sufferings, thinking that all mothers are in such a condition, generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. So, we're talking about, again, we'll talk about this when we talk about the generation of bodhicitta week after next. So, endlessly reborn in cyclic existence, ceaselessly tormented by the three sufferings. So, what are the three sufferings? One, I broke my foot a couple of weeks ago.
The suffering of change.
And the suffering of change. Joanna's a plant over here. What's the third one? Oh, what? Maintenance. I like that. It's also called pervasive suffering. So it just means that we are, because we are the kind of beings that we are, which are out of control, we can't control our minds, and we're caught in this cycle of uncontrolled causation, that suffering is just queuing up. Problems are just queuing up. And for us, happiness, this is this example is the closest I can get to explaining the suffering of change, but it also helps explain the suffering, this pervasive suffering. It's kind of like raw meat, you know, like you've had a burn, like a really painful burn on your arm, and it really, really hurts, and you pour some cool water on it, and you go, oh, God, that's so such a relief. But then it comes right back. Because the nature of it is raw meat. It's been burned. And so this is the pervasive suffering. The most difficult for us to see, and the one we don't want to see. But it's like we are really caught, and we're in a mess. This is a mess. And it's just going to get crazier with the kind of minds we have. Now, the good news is, we can get out of this. This is called samsara. There's a way to get out. Buddhism taught that method. But right now, we're just trying to come to grips with where we are. So what's this? So suffering The first one was suffering and suffering. So that's obvious suffering. Mental and physical pain and suffering. Anybody can see that. You know, you walk in the intensive care unit and somebody's on a ventilator or somebody's, you know, jumping off a bridge because they want to, you know, suicide. That's, or, you know, depression or anxiety or stress or, you know, family problems and financial problems and so on and so on. Those are the biggies, easy to see. Suffering of change, harder to see. Harder to see. In fact, the one we don't want to see. Because everything that we now call happiness and pleasure is really what Buddhism would call the suffering of change. So I'll leave it at that. No, I'm just kidding. The Venerable George talked about it. I think those of you who got a chance to hear him, George Chernoff. But, you know, sometimes the example is, well, you're, you know, the room is kind of hot, isn't it? So if I go outside and I go, as soon as I walk into the bookstore, this place, it's cooler out there. I go, wow, it feels good out here. You know, but in about 5 or 10 minutes, I start getting cold again. And I go, oh, I want to go back in there where it's warm. And I'll come in here and I go, oh, my gosh, it feels good in here. But after a while, it gets hot again, and you go back outside. The pleasure, this experience of a decrease in the pleasure of any experience and an increase in the aversion of it toward it is what gets labeled happiness. So you talk about, let's just go for the big one, sex. Okay? There's, you know, normally people would say, well, that's, you know, how is that suffering? Well, the Buddhist perspective, which is a little different than what, you know, you'd hear on the streets, is that, well, if anything is the true cause of happiness, the more you do it, the better it gets. And sex is not one of those. You know? And if we pay attention to any pleasurable experience, sex being the sort of the supreme example, you know, there's the desire, the clinging for the pleasure of that experience. And as soon as that's there, there's the aversion to sex. So, for example, it's there in the moment that there's clinging for pleasure, there's aversion. Okay? And as the, so again, good food, beautiful sunset, nice vacations, all the same stuff. So as this decrease in the pleasure of those experiences begins to go down, the aversion to those experiences goes up like this. And at some point we go, I've had enough. And you roll over and go to sleep, right? You've had enough. And we go, oh, that was fun, that was pleasure, that was happiness, right? When in fact, what gets labeled happiness or pleasure is just a decrease in our attachment and an increase in our aversion for that particular experience. That's called the suffering of change. Well, you wouldn't wonder, most of us, so am I saying that having fun, going to Disneyland, having sex with your significant other, eating great meals, going on nice vacations, watching beautiful sunsets, and so on and so on. Are we saying that's something to be avoided? Are we saying that's bad? Does it sound? Do you hear that? Who hears that I said it's bad? I didn't say it was bad. Did I? Now, some people are hearing that, because I know I did. I went, oh my God, I got to give up this, I got to give up that. No, the Buddha's not saying, the only thing we have to give up is the attachment. If we can give up the attachment, we can have it all and not suffer. But as long as we're clinging to the pleasure of an experience, we have created an aversion for it automatically. It's the flip side of the coin. So, things, you know, are problematic as long as, if we don't have, another way of saying it is, if we don't have these unrealistic expectations that this meal, this person, this vacation, this sunset, this bottle of wine, this party, whatever it is, fill in the blank. If we don't have the expectation that that's going to bring us anything other than a temporary blip, in other words, we don't have unrealistic expectations, then the suffering is minimized because we're in touch with reality. It's impermanent. It won't last, so we don't cling. You know, clinging in a world that's changing equals suffering. Clinging in a world that's changing equals suffering. Clinging to a pleasurable experience when it's changing will eventually lead to suffering. That's the point. So what's the antidote to clinging? Letting go. Now, easier said than done, but that's the Buddhist teaching, is to train your mind to let go. Train to let go. Yes? It is warm in here. I'm a little bit warm. Can you help us with the suffering of change?
So I'm just curious in what you were just talking about, the way you were bringing up aversion with things that we find pleasurable. Can we consider things like boredom and disappointment to be types of aversion? Because aversion has a kind of connotation, like a bleh, to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's
kind of
the same thing.
If you're bored...
The 20th time skydiving isn't as exciting as the first.
No. If you're bored...
So I'm not averse.
If you're bored, if you feel aversion to boredom, what are you attached to? What's the flip side of that?
I am a thrill junkie.
Yeah, you're an adrenaline junkie. You're not getting your fix. Yeah. Any time we're suffering, we're clinging to something. We're clinging... Aversion is just... I'm clinging to not having this. The thought, I hate this. I'm clinging to that. Okay? That's a negative attachment. So, and if there's something going on, like I'm in a relationship and it's beginning to dissolve, you know, disappear into somebody that I truly love, but they're leaving me for somebody else and so on and so forth, you know, I go, oh, you know, I'm clinging to my expectations of that great relationship that I thought I had. And it causes me to suffer. I have to let go. So anytime we're suffering, the antidote to the suffering is to let go. But it's so hard to do, isn't it? This is the whole path. The whole path is about training us to not suffer and also develop our positive qualities. It's more than just stopping suffering. Stopping suffering is nirvana. That's the goal for the intermediate scope. All right. So the definition of having generated the mind of enlightenment. In short, if like the mother whose cherished son has fallen into a pit of fire, who experiences even 1 second of his suffering as an unbearable eternity, your reflection on the suffering of all mother sentient beings has made it impossible for you to bear their suffering even for 1 second, the wish seeking enlightenment for their sake arises without effort, then you realize the supreme precious mind of enlightenment. All right, so this Bodhi mind, the mind of enlightenment, this altruistic intention to become enlightened is great, but it's not enough. It's not enough. But it is, it's what distinguishes the Theravada from the Mahayana, you know, from the motivation for individual liberation, which is the middle scope, to the motivation for a liberation for the sake of all sentient beings, which is the Mahayana motive that we're aspiring to cultivate. Then, I'm going to read through this next part. We're just going to read straight through it because it's cryptic. And I don't want to try to dig it out right now. But it's all about wisdom. It's all about wisdom and the wisdom of emptiness. Oh, by the way, one time I was, I can't remember what date it was. I think it was like, sometimes anyway. I was in Nepal in Kathmandu at this monastery where Lama Zopa was the main person and the main teacher. And I was getting ready to come back to this country. And I said, gosh, Rinpoche, I was telling him I was afraid I was going to die and all this kind of stuff. And he kind of laughed at me and said, well, you're going to die. You got to be doing something when you're dying. You know, you might be flying or you might be doing doctoring or you might be doing something, but you're going to die anyway. And then he Then he said something that was kind of interesting. He said, without emptiness, you can't get free. He said, renunciation and bodhicitta are great, but without the correct view of reality, you cannot stop your suffering. Pretty interesting. And then he went on, like, for about 30 minutes, just telling me about... I mean, it was like he was sitting there describing what he was seeing to me. That's how I viewed it, because he was, it was a very powerful moment for me. But let's just read this. Without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, even though you've generated renunciation in the mind of enlightenment, you cannot cut the root cause of circling. Therefore, attempt the method to realize dependent arising. Okay, now wait a minute. Dependent arising. You're going to hear this again and again. What the heck does that mean? Everybody should know that by now. No, they shouldn't. This is. I'm going to say it. I'm going to try to say it every week from now on until the class is over. But we talk about how things depend upon our mind. Remember last week? We were talking about the book, right? And a dog sees or a baby doesn't see a book. We see a book. Why? Because this book exists for us in dependence upon the label. Book. Okay? There's this, whatever this is, and independence upon the label, we're able to see a book. So, this book exists independence upon a mind that labels it. Wouldn't you say? It does. It exists independence. In other words, there's an interdependence between this book and my mind, just for its existence. This is what the Buddha is saying. So, dependent arising proves emptiness, and emptiness is supported by an understanding of dependent arising. So, here's how it goes. Everything arises or comes into existence in dependence upon causes and conditions. That's karma. Everything has its own individual, unique sets of causes and conditions. It doesn't just pop out of nowhere. This book, when we look at it, it looks like everybody would see it as a book. You leave the room and I put it down, it's still a book. You come back in the room, it's a book. It's almost like bookness is here right in the object. Wouldn't you say that? Wouldn't you say that? Think about it. Don't just agree with me. This is a crucial, important point. It looks like the book exists from the side of the book, completely independent of our mind labeling it. But the book exists independence upon a mind that labels it. It exists independence upon causes and conditions. A lot of things went into making this book, not only the teachings, but anything. All the things that create the book, the causes and conditions, and it exists independence upon its parts. Lots of pages, but bazillions of atoms, many, many parts. So the point is, it exists in a dependent fashion. It depends on things for its existence. It doesn't exist independently. It sounds like a semantic game, but it's way bigger than that. It's the biggest message in all of Buddhism, is that everything has this interdependent relationship. Nothing exists independently there. And so, when we talk about dependent arising, we say things exist in dependence upon causes and conditions, in dependence upon parts, and in dependence upon a consciousness that designates it, that labels it, that projects it. This is what creates it. This is how things exist. And you go, well, that's not so profound. Exist dependence upon causes and conditions. Yeah, I got that. Parts. Yeah, I can see the parts. Yeah, the mind that labels it. I can see that. That's not so profound, is it? That's not that big a deal. But it exactly contradicts the way it appears to our mind. It exists in a dependent arising. But in fact, it looks like it exists independent of everything. Even the most important thing for us to get is that the way we exist, we project a false sense of I. Now, we do exist, obviously, right? We're here. There's a mind and a body. Those aggregates, the mind and body, are here. And that's it. That's enough. But what we do is ignorance projects a false sense of I, and we cling to that I as if it were real, independent, inherently existing, existing hardwired, like there's something really there. That's who I am. If you insult me, I will get angry, or I might even kill you. And if you're nice to me, you will be labeled my friend. Me, I. Same thing. There's this appearance to the mind of an I that exists independent of causes and conditions, parts, which would be moments of mind, and a consciousness that designates it. Same thing. So the I, which we believe in so strongly, is who we really are. Also, we can use this reasoning called dependent arising to prove that there's no I that exists that way. We do exist, but not that way. We exist mind and body, merely label I. That's it. Nothing else, nothing more, nothing less. That's who we are, and we can function, and we do function in the world. Everything else is the projection of ignorance. Everything else is what causes samsara to keep circling. It's ignorance, this misperception of reality. Our own personal reality and the reality of everything else. So, let's read this. Because, you know, it might be hard. When you first hear this, you go, oh my God. But if you read it again and again and again and you get an explanation of it, it's quite beautiful. All right. One who sees the cause and effect of all phenomena of both cyclic existence and the state beyond Sara as forever unbetraying, and for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind has completely disappeared, has at that time entered the path pleasing the Buddhas. Now, let me just say one thing. Completely disappears. This is in meditation. If you do meditation on emptiness and you try to find this inherently existent self or I or this object out there that seems so real and you don't find it, the non-finding of that, you know, you're left with space. And they call it space-like meditative equipoise on emptiness. So don't get caught up in the language. But when it says when everything completely disappears, it doesn't mean things don't exist. That's just part of this process of realizing emptiness. Then the next stanza. If the appearance of dependent relation, which is unbetraying, is accepted separately from emptiness, and as long as they are seen as separate, then one does not realize the Buddha's intent. If these two realizations are happening simultaneously without alternation, and by merely seeing dependent relation as completely unbetraying, the definite ascertainment comes that completely destroys the way all objects are apprehended as truly existent, at that time the analysis of the ultimate view is complete. Furthermore, appearance eliminates the extreme of existence, and emptiness eliminates the extreme of non-existence. If you realize how emptiness manifests in the manner of cause and effect, you are not captivated by wrong notions holding extreme views. In this way, you realize exactly the vital points, three principal aspects of the path, resort to seeking solitude, generate the power of effort, and quickly accomplish your final goal, my child. We just have a few more minutes to go, but I wanted to go back to that next to the last stanza. It sounds crazy. It says, furthermore, appearance, the fact that things appear, eliminates the extreme of existence, which you're talking about is inherent existence. And emptiness, the emptiness of inherent existence, eliminates the extreme of non-existence. So we've got to put some thought into that. If you realize how emptiness manifests in a manner of cause and effect, then you're not captivated by wrong notion holding extreme views. So the take-home point here is this. No matter how kind of ungraspable and maybe you can't quite, you know, maybe you're having, I mean, everybody, we all struggle with emptiness. I don't care how many years you've been studying it, it's still elusive. It, you know, takes a long time to just to begin to understand it intellectually. But don't ever get to the point where you think that cause and effect is not real, because it is. And we can't, emptiness doesn't mean that nothing exists. It doesn't matter what you do. You do whatever you want to do because it's all empty. You know, a lot of Westerners have justified some pretty bad behaviors, saying, well, emptiness just means that, you know, it's all a projection. You know, I can do whatever I want to do. Not so. Not so. So this is the end of that prayer. And if you're motivated to memorize it, I think it's a great prayer to that or the foundation of all good qualities. So let's go ahead. I was going to have next week. I'll do it. I have a little gimmick I want us to do, but we'll do it next week. I have to get us back up to speed here. So let's do the dedication prayers. Shanti Deva's prayer. I don't have it. Got a book. May all beings everywhere, plagued by the sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merit. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored or finding repose. May the naked find clothing and the hungry find food. May the poor find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from the ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Okay, so thank you. Next week we'll finish up the middle scope. We'll touch on some. We'll do more meditation next week. We'll do a bunch of little mini meditations, and then we'll finish up the middle scope. And then the next week we'll get into the Mahayana, the higher scope teachings. Okay. Anybody has any questions? I'll stick around. What? Oh, you know what the card... All right, well, all right, here's what you do with the cards. If you got a minute, write down two things. One thing that you got out of tonight that's really going to... that you think is going to make a difference in the next... Maybe forever. So one thing you got... Maybe it's just a concept that you understood for the first time. Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is something... that is fuzzy, that you want some more clarification. This will help me. You know, what you writing out down what you got out of it would help you. You telling me what's fuzzy, that'll help me.